Hello and welcome to Provox, a podcast from the Queen's College, Oxford.
Thank you so much, Sharon, for coming along. This is the last of these events this academic year, but by no means the least. Sharon has had one of the most extraordinary careers, I think, of anyone that I've come across. She's been in very senior positions right across the civil service, in the Treasury and Department for Work and Pensions, Minister of Justice, Department for International Development, and Number 10. She's worked in Washington, and of course was the head of Ofcom, has been the chair of John Lewis, and is now chair of an economics consultancy, and works at for a big Canadian pension fund. I think I've covered the main bases there, Sharon.
And I'm only 25, but I've just managed to pack an awful lot into a very small number of years.
So there's an awful lot we can talk about there. And if it's okay, we'll mostly talk about the issues, as it were. But it will be really good if you could just maybe say, in your own words, something about your career. You came from rather different background to most of the people who are in these very senior positions. I forgot to say she's a baroness as well, and in the House of Lords. So we might talk a little bit about the House of Lords as well. You grew up sort of a daughter of parents who immigrated from the West Indies in East London, and then via Cambridge come into all these extraordinary places. So perhaps you could just tell us a little bit about that journey. That's a rather open-ended question, I realise.
So if anybody's got about 5 hours, forget the heat. So first of all, thank you so much for coming tonight. And it's really lovely to see some people I've worked with very closely over the period when you could be out sort of punting or eating ice creams and doing lots of other things. And I'm now a bit more connected with Oxford because my husband is doing Paul's job at Trinity. So thank you so much for coming tonight. So maybe a few things. I've had a slightly odd career, I guess. My parents, as Paul said, were part of the Windrush generation. And it's extraordinary now. I've got boys who are 21 and almost 19. My mother came as a 19-year-old in the early 1960s, and her father sold a field so that she could take the plane rather than take the boat. And basically, she only went back to Jamaica twice during all that period. And if any of you are either immigrants yourself or know lots of immigrants, people still talk about home. And it always used to puzzle me that my parents talked about Jamaica as home when we basically, most of their adult life and time had been spent in London. And then my dad emigrated early 1960s, and they met here. My brother and I were both born here. And I would say I've been incredibly, incredibly lucky. So I grew up in East London. I was a very odd, sort of slightly nerdy child who...
I think you're talking to a room full who are like that.
My parents had barely gone to school. My mother left school when she was 11. My dad left school when he was about 13 or 14. So they could write a bit, they could read a bit, but I was very conscious growing up that even the fact that I went to school until I was 18 was a sort of extraordinary thing to have done. And my dad and I used to watch the boat race together, and obviously always supported Cambridge because East London was slightly closer. And I always was just very, very interested in books and learning, and school was a much sort of happier space in many ways than home. So, Jamaican households are not necessarily, they're quite complicated households because of all the sort of history of sort of colonization in the Caribbean. And I had, when I was 16, I did reasonably well in my then O-levels, if people recognize GCSEs. And there was just this incredibly cool economics teacher at school who'd been to Cambridge. I think most of the sixth form girls at my school quite fancied him. So I think a lot of people decided to do A-level economics, partly because he was this very inspiring teacher. And it's because of him that a number of us three in my year went to Cambridge, because it was a sort of bridge between, you know, it was an all girls comprehensive and a world that in one way we were sort of desperate to get into. But on the other hand, I guess sort of culturally, you know, racially, class-wise, all those things in the mid-1980s was a slightly sort of foreign country.
And then from, tell us just a bit about how you then thought about your life after that. And so you went through all of these different bits of the civil service and into Ofcom. I mean, did you have any sense when you started off? You started off in the civil service, didn't you?
Yeah.
Did you have any sense then of what you were doing, where you wanted to end up?
So I don't know. I mean, there are probably lots of people in the audience who were very sensible and had sort of career plans, and maybe at an early age always knew that you wanted to be an academic, or, you know, it was a particular subject that sort of you were very passionate about. And I was always somebody, as I studied economics, very like Paul, I'm very interested in how sort of kind of governments and businesses can act for the common good. And as I look back on a sort of 40-year career, I can sort of express it in a way that probably feels more planned and more ordered than it seemed at the time. And I joined the civil service in the late 1980s because I was, I was very interested in politics. I was very interested in economics. It was the Thatcher era, lots of privatisations, you know, lots happening sort of in the world of economics. And I probably thought I was going to do sort of 18 months, and I stayed for 26 years. And I think one of the great advantages, and you've been in the public sector as well, is that it gives you the opportunity to do lots of very different things. I worked effectively on what you call sort of social protection. How do you get people closer to the labour market? How do you ensure that pensioners, we would do some work together, got great living standards? And I did a similar version of that internationally. And then after 26 years, I was sort of in my late 40s and thought, you know, I wonder whether, you know, there's any possibility that I might be able to do something. You know, I'm either going to get my gold watch in the civil service age 75, or are there some skills and some interests that I've built up in the civil service that might be useful elsewhere? And then I went to Ofcom, so I ran the media and telecoms regulator, which is one of the scariest and most enjoyable things I've done. So sort of dealing with everything from BBC regulation to Rupert Murdoch's sons appearing on a Monday morning, essentially having to evacuate the building to make sure that none of the conversations are recorded. And again, it's business, but it's business as a regulator that you're trying to be more focused on the consumer and more focused on the public good. And then even the John Lewis Partnership, and I don't know how many are Waitrose or John Lewis shoppers, and you probably need to put an extra item in your basket at the end of the week. I mean, the reason for going is, you know, yes, I'm a shopper, but because it's what the founder described as an experiment in industrial democracy. You've got this sort of 70,000 person business with 21 million customers that's basically trying to run itself a bit like a giant social enterprise with a constitution that forbids it from maximizing profit, that has a mission which is about basically making the world a happier place, with a governance structure that probably makes the governance of an Oxford college look like an incredibly straightforward decision-making process with lots of elected officials and lots of consultation and lots of democratic structure.
We were talking about earlier, it did sound very similar.
And again, it's how a big business can satisfy its customers, but also do something that's special in the world.
Amazing. I mean, I'll stop asking the personal questions after this one, but all the way through this, I mean, did you ever feel sort of out of place because of your background? I mean, how did you navigate any of that?
I mean, it's a great question, but in a way, and I think it will be different for my kids now growing up in a much more multicultural society, is when I grew up, we were the And I think I mentioned this to you, we were the only black family on our street. My dad, who was a very interesting personality, still going at 90, basically never wanted to live with the other Jamaicans. And so he deliberately wanted to live in an English, very, very white, very working class part of East London. So so outside our sort of family, and I've got very little family in this country, from when I went to nursery school to primary school to being at the Treasury or some of these other spaces, I've never known what it's like not to be a minority. So I actually find it, I mean, it hasn't happened very often. It's probably about twice in my life, both times in the States where I've been in a sort of professional meeting that's been sort of majority African-American. And it feels really odd. And it's slightly that, oh gosh, should I act in a different way? It's very odd because I'm so used to, Richard and I were on a board together. Mark and I were in the civil service together. It's such an unusual occurrence to be, in a room where people look like me, and I don't resent it. It's just, that's the space that I'm very content in, but it's the space that I've grown up in.
And in the end, I think, whatever your background, you do end up with people who are in a different sense like you in terms of their interests and ambitions and all those sorts of things. I want to spend most of the time on Ofcom and John Lewis, but I can't. We have to say something about life in the civil service. Now, I mean, you were in the Treasury for a long time, so we can't talk about all the policy over that period. So I just wanted to ask really one question about a couple of the departments that you were in. You were in the Treasury for a long time. You're second permanent secretary there. The Treasury, most people don't obviously work there, but everyone sort of probably has a sense of the Treasury. I mean, it gets talked about all of the time as the most powerful department in government. The department's always saying no. I mean, it's not very popular in the popular imagination. I mean, is it as powerful as it's made out to be? Where does that power come from? And I mean, does it do a good job?
Oh gosh, okay, these are all sort of 5-hour questions. So when I was, those titles are so arcane, but the last job I did at the Treasury, please forgive me, as second permanent secretary, I was in charge of the public finances during the austerity period. So during the point, I'm afraid, when Nick Clegg and the Lib Dems and the Conservatives raised tuition fees close to where they are today and did lots of other very difficult things for higher education. I would say a few things. So, as a department, it's probably the most, and this is a very odd word to use, but it's probably the most fun place to be as a civil servant. It's a very young department, so the modal age is probably 24, 25. The modal background is probably still PPE at Balliol.
Still time for Queen's people to take over.
No, exactly. And when people, I always think that sort of when people looked at me from a diversity perspective at the Treasury, it wasn't being a black woman; it was the fact that I'd gone to Cambridge and and done a straight economics degree. And people used to say, "It's fine." I think it's basically they'd sort of pray forgiveness. It's quite an anarchic department, I would say. So it's a very, very unhierarchical. If you're the smartest person, you might be 2 or 3 years out of university, but you're the person that the chancellor or the chief secretary wants to talk to. And that makes it a very dynamic, quite high stress, but very sort of dynamic place to work. Yes, of course it's powerful because it's because ultimately no major policy, the government can't make any major move that generally doesn't have money attached to it. It obviously has particularly powerful, effective phases, and that's very linked to the character and the vision of a chancellor. So probably during my time, and again, Mark may disagree with me, probably the Gordon Brown era and the Nigel Lawson era. Nigel Lawson, who was an unusually reformist chancellor. Gordon Brown, where the Treasury effectively became not just the centre of all things finance and economics, but basically was the centre of all domestic policy making with Tony Blair, certainly during the first term, a bit less in the second term, basically sort of delegated to going off and, you know, doing foreign affairs. Where, as you know, things get very difficult in the Treasury is that it's very imbalanced between the side of the Treasury that I worked on, which is we'd like to say no. Nobody else in government is going to say no to bad spending. And it can mean that you lose sight of effective investment. So you cut capital spending, you cut the investment on roads and house building and transport, because it's the easy thing to do in the short term. But there's obviously, as we're seeing now, with 30 years of underinvestment, has deleterious impacts in the medium term.
Is that the Treasury or is that the Chancellor? I know it's a very hard thing to distinguish, but my sense has normally been that officials would say to the Chancellor, actually, the cutting investment is a bad thing to do, but the politically easiest thing to do.
It is, but I think it's because, and these things are very linked, I think the finance ministry side of the Treasury is so much more dominant than the bit of the Treasury which is thinking about growth and planning reform and how do you have a higher education system where you've got amazing graduates who are then equipped with AI and about to go into the world and find jobs and give back. It's very, very imbalanced. And indeed, we used to talk about the growth side of the Treasury being a bit like having a spending department with the enemy almost within the building. I think the Treasury had a very difficult financial crisis and it had a very difficult Brexit. So if you're talking about periods where the Treasury really sort of, I think, lost its bearings, and I think it's having... we could talk more about this in the Q&A. I think it's having quite a tough time currently.
Well, we'll definitely do that in that case. I don't want to get too much into sort of how central government works, and Sharon and I are probably a little bit too close to this. But do you think we need to change the sort of architecture of should we have a growth department and a finance department? Should we move something out of the Treasury into whatever the Department of Trade and Industry is now called, or the Cabinet Office, or do you think we just need, that's just daft and we should make work what we've got?
Again, others will have views. I think this is not about structures and rearranging deck chairs. I think governments and the civil service work when there is a very clear plan for what ministers and the government want to do.
It's having a difficult time at the moment.
And it's having a very difficult time. And I don't know how many of you have read the Tony Blair's 5,000 words of very well-timed intervention. But if you've got whatever your views, if you've got a strong government that is coherent, that has worked out the trade-offs in opposition, and has a reasonable idea of delivery, that's 95% of the way to being effective. And I think we could talk more about this. I mean, I worked for Tony Blair in 97 as a civil servant, and they had spent much more of the period in opposition working through the choices and the trade-offs and what they wanted to do in government. And even then, it took them until the second term really to have a public services agenda that's basically lasted the test of time and lasted beyond a particular party. It's very difficult to do, and this government came in. I don't know how to even describe it. I mean, to say completely unprepared feels like an understatement.
We'll move on, but it's very much my take on life in the civil service as well. I mean, a lot of you will have watched Yes Minister, at least a lot of the older people in the audience have watched Yes Minister, where you get the sense that politicians are sort of bumbling buffoons who don't do anything and everything's run by the civil service. But the truth is the civil service really does need direction because it's the elected ministers who give it that direction. And if they but they can give it the wrong direction, and one of the frustrating things is they can tell you to do some really stupid things and you have to go and do them. Chris Grayling. But equally, if you don't get that direction, it's all over the place, then it's very hard to make anything work.
And I would also say that the Treasury really needs a strong number 10. So the Treasury sort of culturally is set up to propose some mad things, recognising that at some point the Prime Minister will step in and say, that is a very mad thing, we're going to recalibrate.
By mad things, you mean the sorts of things that economists think are a good idea, but politicians shouldn't
abolish the Navy because we need to save money on defence. And when you don't have that calibration, what happens is that the Treasury proposal sort of runs and runs and runs, and the officials are thinking, oh my goodness, there's no balancing item. Do we need to sort of... And as I say, we can talk about some of the detail that's happened in the last couple of years, but part of it is, I'm sure the winter fuel payments is probably in this category, is the Treasury always has a list. And then it assumes at some stage there's a sort of political balancing item that prevents the worst of the list from ever appearing in daylight. And as I say, a strong Treasury, for the Treasury to be effective, it really needs a strong first Lord of the Treasury, i.e. the Prime Minister.
Yeah, which is, we can talk about this further, because, I mean, the trouble is most of the most unpopular things this government has done from the Treasury are exactly the sort of things I think is a good idea. Winter fuel allowances, of course you can get rid of them, but politically it doesn't work quite so well. No one ever elect
me
to anything.
That's why you're head of house and not
exactly, absolutely, that's why I'm absolutely not a politician. let's dance very quickly through a couple of other things. So you spent a little bit of time at DFID as one of the most senior officials there, and again, this is a subject for several hours. We've gone through this extraordinary period where, during those austerity years you were talking about, there seemed to be at least what I think is now called an elite consensus that overseas aid spending should rise and rise fast to 0.7% of national income, and that was forced through by a Conservative coalition government. And then that's been cut to 0.5%, and now the Labour government has cut it to 0.3% of GDP. Now that, I think, is the lowest level of overseas aid spending since we started doing overseas aid in the early 60s, which is an extraordinary shift in the sort of elite consensus, if you want to call it that. Again, we could talk about this for ages. What's your sense of partly why that might have happened? I mean, the answer's obvious in a sense, which is politically, it's better to spend money on the health service than on people in other countries. But do you think there's a sort of just failure? Do you think there's a failure in reality to spend the money wisely, or a failure of communication that it is spent wisely, or just a sort of shifting priorities?
So I think a few things. I think most people know there's been a sort of target of 0.7% of GDP has been around forever, and basically only the Scandinavians had
in real money is about 20 billion a year now if we were doing that, and we're down under 10. So it's an extraordinary difference.
Yeah, and it's interesting because obviously in 1997 the Labour government set up a dedicated Department for International Development under, some of you will remember, Clare Short, and raised the amount of overseas aid, but always stop short of having a legislative target. And my own view, and I think if you talk to, various people who are sort of quite sort of senior in this world, I think when you start to have a target for spending, whether it's higher education, whether it's housing, whether it's international development, and so the purpose of the department is to hit a spending goal, rather than to deliver certain outcomes in terms of development or poverty reduction, you're basically on the hiding to nothing. And you could almost hear the clock ticking as soon as the piece of legislation that enshrined that, that if you're another department, so if you're the Foreign Office thinking, gosh, I've, you know, those aid guys got quite a lot of money. So the first thing that happens is that everything that then gets reclassified. And we used to have this terrible phrase called tucking under. So suddenly, literally, housing for asylum seekers in the UK came under the international development budget. So I think it's the fallacy of political signals delivered through arbitrary, artificial spending targets. And you know, as you know, you're probably the UK's great expert on this. As money gets tighter, and I think all the, you know, probably the diminution in social cohesion in the last few years, and a sense in which supporting people overseas is somehow not in the UK's interest. You know, even with the pandemic, even with, you know, what unfortunately is now happening in the Congo with Ebola, it becomes easier and easier politically to say, well, actually, I'm going to spend more on defence. And the easiest place to get that is not by having a sensible conversation about our social security safety net, but about hitting, unfortunately, some of the poorest vulnerable people overseas.
Did you get a sense that all the money, well, that it was well spent? Were you worried there that actually, maybe we could do this a bit better?
I just have always thought that having a target is a mistake. And it means eventually you start to write large checks alongside some of the big institutions, the European Commission, the World Bank. I think some of the money was very well spent. I think DFID was a very, very effective organisation as a small expert body without an artificial spending target.
Let's move on. It's such an extraordinary career. There's so much to talk about.
Would you like to move on to?
Let's go on to Ofcom. Now, this is something about which I really don't know anything. So I'm definitely, you'll definitely have to lead this conversation even more. But just remind us what is Ofcom responsible for?
Yes, it's a very good question. So the Office for Communications, my kids always say, Mummy, what's Ofcom? What is it that you do all day? And I mean, it's responsible for about half the business world. So all of telecommunications, so mobile phone and fixed broadband, satellites, which were just about coming on the scene when I was there, mobile phones, so we were just arguing about the fact that there is no 4G and no 5G signal in Oxford, so I'm deeply apologetic. Also the media, so broadcasting, and then we also took on responsibility for the BBC while I was there, Royal Mail, so if anybody ever still posts the letter, which I think now costs about £1.80 for first class stamp. And then I was there for 5 years, and during the last year it was just the beginning of the discussion around regulating the online world. So the legislation hadn't come through, but we were already sort of knocking on the door very, very loudly at the likes of Google and YouTube. And, you know, the door was opening to a very small crack.
That is an extraordinary coverage. I mean, to what extent? So Ofcom is set up as an independent regulator. What does independence mean in that context? Because a lot of that is very political and affects people's everyday lives. And, you know, if it's about the BBC or about online regulation and all this sort of, it's very, very political. How do you tread that line between being independent, but also presumably not entirely, you know, ignoring where the government of the day is?
Yeah, and there's a much bigger conversation to be had as to whether as many decisions should sit with unelected officials as opposed to politicians. It's a very difficult line to tread in practice. So maybe a couple of examples. When I was chief executive, there were two of the biggest mobile operators, O2, Telefonica, I don't know if anybody has O2, and Hutchinson 3, so the new challenger, wanted to merge. And we worked very hard with the European Commission to knock back the merger. The owner of 3 still is the biggest single direct investor into the UK, and every so often would send his mistress, if I'm allowed to say this, his mistress and his right-hand person on a private jet to come and lobby me at the office. And basically to step into a space where you're essentially saying to a sort of multi-billionaire, super connected investor that we think the decision that you're trying to take is bad for consumers, I would not have done that without basically making sure that the Prime Minister and his team and his team's team and the cat and the dog were all supportive, because it got very, very hairy. I had, you know, they did a whole advertising campaign. They did a, there was a, I can't remember, we have talked about this, but they did a screenshot of me sort of 8 feet tall, quite tall, 8 feet tall against my son's school. So all sorts of very odd things. And so in those sorts of circumstances, the easiest and the worst thing for a regulator is to get a call from somebody in the Prime Minister's office or somebody in the Chancellor's office to say, actually, you need to pull back from this because basically you don't have a job. You've completely lost your ability to operate. And then with the BBC, I mean, I have to say I was much luckier than I think my successor Melanie Dawes is at Ofcom. So when we took on regulation of the BBC, basically nobody wanted to give it to Ofcom. And I didn't want to take it on, because you're always worried with the BBC that, you know, we had a big enough job with everything else going on, that the BBC, as you know, probably the worst job in the country is being Director General, because you have such a short shelf life. You might have 1 week without a scandal, but, you know, week two, something's coming. And I just was always worried that we would get sort of caught up in the soap opera. And again, we worked really closely with the department behind the scenes to make sure that as the regulations were set up, essentially it was BBC first. So the BBC, it was the BBC's job essentially to sort out its house. And then we were in as a backstop, because the alternative would be that we'd have spent 95% of our time dealing with, I'm very sorry, but I was watching, you know, I was listening to the Today programme this morning and Paul Johnson was on. And, you know, we don't understand why we didn't have, you know, an opposing view. And you basically go down a rabbit hole. So it's a difficult dance. So the companies that you regulate need to know that you don't have a politician sort of pulling the strings. But on the very big decisions, you've got to make sure that you've got enough sort of license to operate, so that you're not going to get a sort of midnight call that sort of pulls the rug from under your feet.
I can't stop myself asking this. The Competition and Markets Authority, the chairman was sacked last year, yes, effectively, because I think he was doing things the government didn't like. Presumably, this is this dance going wrong.
Yeah, it's the dance going on, but also I mean, you'll know this well, the most high upturn point for any regulator is a change of government. Mm. So, you know, the previous chair at the CMA clearly felt that he and the organisation were running a very pro-competition, pro-consumer institution, and a new government comes along and says, well, growth is our biggest mission. And we don't quite know how to get growth, but we've got these regulators that might be preventing growth. And I think, you know, working out how are these independent bodies survive and navigate a change of political, not just change of government, but change of political party, particularly when these parties are in for 13, 14 years, is really tough.
It's quite hard for civil service departments to navigate that. I mean, even changing ministers, changing from Gordon Brown to Alistair Darling even was quite difficult in the Treasury. you talked about the sort of head of Ofcom dealing with billionaires. I mean, Ofcom, how on earth do you deal with these mega company like your Googles and your Metas and so on? You're trying to, I mean, these are global companies worth billions or trillions, huge power. And you're in Ofcom's, what, a couple of thousand staff or something?
Yeah, it was 800, I think it's now 1200.
Trying to go up against, I mean, how?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure this is, this recording is not going anywhere. I mean, I think it's very difficult for a domestic regulator, whether you're in the UK or Australia or Germany or Peru, to regulate multinational companies like Google or Meta. I think it's an impossible job, because the so-called remedies, if something goes wrong and you set up, punishments and fines, or, you say to Mark Zuckerberg, if he were wanting to buy Instagram today and we were concerned about it, what would happen? So Instagram's not available to UK consumers, but it's available globally and you can plug in a VPN. So I think you can only regulate these companies if it's part of an international agreement, or whether the US body, the FTC, starts first. So what you're beginning to see, which is always the way in the US, is that they never regulate and then they get sued. And so there are a couple of, as you've probably seen, there are a couple of court cases that have been lost in terms of the harm from these very addictive algorithms. And I think what will happen in practice is that they'll have to start changing their business models. Not because a UK regulator in a country of 60, 65 million people have laid down legislation, but because actually it's fundamental to their business model in their biggest market.
Interesting. Would it be easier if we're in the European Union to regulate in that at that scale? I mean, even when we were in the EU, I mean, did Ofcom follow that?
I mean, well, look at what's happening today. I mean, so the European Union now has the strictest regulation on artificial intelligence in the world. And what's happening, it's now part of the, US-European trade negotiations, with the US administration essentially trading off the regulation against so-called big tech for more open access to the US market. I don't think it works. I think this only works with the US getting its house in order in the domestic market for these companies.
Well, it's a good thing the US is well governed at the moment. move on to John Lewis. You took over at a really difficult time. Was it just the moment before the pandemic struck?
It was 5 weeks, I think, before COVID. And I think I was just finishing off my induction meetings, and I had an email through from... I think it must have been the upholstery or the sofa team in John Lewis saying, we've got some news from China, and we're due to run the advertising campaign for new sofas on a Monday. I think there's a problem with the ships, but I think we'll be able to run the campaign on a Wednesday. And I think by the Friday we knew that the problem with the ship was basically the start of obviously, but then turned out to be sort of 2.5 years of COVID, probably much harder for students and the higher education world than it was even for retail. So, yeah, so I started in the January, and I think on March, the results on March the 6th, and on March the 13th, we had a Saturday morning phone call to close all 52 John Lewis stores. Not sure whether we would basically ever reopen the business.
Wow. I mean, it was hard running an organization where I'd, been doing it for quite a long time, and a much, much, much smaller organization, as you kind of had to adapt to online. How on earth did you do that as a brand new in this huge organization, which is actually at the front line the retail?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure if I look back now, I think, oh my God, how did I manage to get out of bed every morning? But I think, if you've been in retail for even if you've been in retail for 50 years, nobody had ever had a phone call which was, we might be about to close the entirety of your business, or we might be about to lock down the entire country, and if you run a supermarket, you've basically got to figure out how you sort of deliver groceries to people who are only allowed out of their homes 1 hour a day. And so I got to know the other retailers, Simon Wolfson at Next and Archie Norman at M&S very well. I mean, none of us had a playbook for that. And in a way, the advantage of, I'd lived through the financial crisis, I'd lived through, the UK coming out of the arm. I was very used to crises and unexpected things happening in quite sort of complex spaces. And we had an amazing team. And so we had, one part of the business that's sort of trying to basically figure out how do you keep people safe? Because obviously at the early days, we didn't know how COVID was transmitted. We were, trying to procure lots of, PPP, which was then going to the NHS. So you're sort of sending out your teams into Waitrose stores, not quite sure whether you're putting them at risk. So all of those things you sort of work through with, well, what's the most important thing that we can do? Number one is to keep people safe. Number two is to try to deliver for customers if we still can. And number three, if we could possibly affect it, is to still have a business whenever that's through. And we ended COVID, to be frank, pretty financially challenged. So difficult as it was, COVID also enabled us to take some really, really difficult decisions on stores and numbers of people and, getting our technology modernised that would have probably taken us much longer to have done without a crisis. So yeah, I think when you're in, I'm sure everybody's got their experiences, and some people in the room probably lost relations or had people going through sickness. So there's nothing by comparison. But I think when you're in the moment, your sort of adrenaline just takes over. I think it's when you look back that you think, oh my goodness, and we had school-aged children at home as well. It was quite a moment.
I bet it was. The long-term impact on retail, I mean, what's your view of that, in-person retail, the high street versus online? Is that changed fundamentally? I mean, you go into the sort of Westgate Centre on a Saturday, it's still absolutely rammed, but I don't know what your view is as to how things have changed.
Yeah, I've been out a couple of years, but if I look at the partnership, obviously it was a big department stores and groceries. The partnership went into COVID 40% online and is now 62% online. So what that does in just in terms of the economics of the business, you've got a lot of, you're trying to serve customers however people want to shop. Whether that's, I think John Lewis is now on Deliveroo as well since I left. So whether you need, whether you've got some guests coming around tonight and you don't have glasses and you need them in 15 minutes time, but you don't want to go to Westgate, or whether you're moving house in 6 months time and you're having an in-person conversation with an amazing guy, John Lewis, who can take you through a £10,000 purchase and new curtains and all of that being done brilliantly. How you do that, preserving your margins in a profitable way, has got tougher, and I think the new team's doing a brilliant job. And on the grocery side, we obviously had the deal with Ocado, which we had a little bit of a divorce just before I started. And so Waitrose was 3% online, and it's now 15% online. So, it says as much about the UK.
Still 85% in person.
It is, but it's a, the warehousing, the supply chain, all of that is a much, much, much more complicated business. And it's a feature of the UK. So the UK has been structurally much more affected by COVID in the sense that we're now So most other countries have kind of gone back to looking a bit like they did before in terms of online shopping, in terms of working from home. The UK, the impact has been much more systematic.
Any idea why?
It's a great question. I suspect it's a sort of combination of housing costs and transport. We're a high convenience country. So I think we and the Estonians are the...
So it's either because our transport's rubbish or because we're lazy. That we've come to the end of the time. I think you'll agree two things. First, I think you've seen someone, you can understand why Sharon has achieved everything that she's achieved just from the way that we've had this conversation today. You've seen what it takes to be a leader and to be someone who also clearly cares about the thing that she's doing. I hope you'll also agree that despite the wonderful weather outside, this was a wonderful way of spending an hour. So Sharon, thank you so much.